Good evening. It's 6 minutes after seven. This is the evening edition of Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellen.
I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
We are in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio and bringing you this evening edition of Ozarks at Large. Our phone volunteers, though, are not in the building. We have sent them, hopefully, safely on their way home.
No, and we have volunteers in the building because, well, we had volunteers right in the building because it is our spring on-air fundraiser. At 7 o'clock, we let them go home and just ask that listeners make their contributions online at our website, supportkuaf.com.
It's a very simple process. You determine the amount of the contribution that you make. You also determine the method. You can do it all at once. You can do it over a few installments. You can actually become a sustaining member, too, which means you pledge $5, $10, $20 a month in perpetuity on your debit card or bank draft, or if you work for the University of Arkansas, through payroll deduction. Any of those options are available. Any amount works because we all work together to make sure that we have enough money to bring you the programs that you listen to.
Yes, our annual budget is a little over $1 million every year, and we are responsible for raising 88% of that. And we are able to do that through listener contributions and local underwriters and the occasional grant here and there. But the vast majority of support comes from the local community. Something like 66% of our budget, our income, comes from listeners who call in and make their pledges, as well as local businesses who sign up for underwriting.
Right. So two-thirds coming from you and your neighbors and people just like you who listen to and use KUAF. That's a significant portion of your budget, and it shows you just how important you are to this program and to all the programs on KUAF. Literally, without you, we wouldn't be doing this.
That's right. It's a unique model, but it's one that works for KUAF and for public radio everywhere. And it's worked for KUAF for almost three decades. Because of listener support, we have been around for three decades, and the only way that we can remain here is with more listener support.
That's right. And because we have grown, we're almost 500,000 people in the Northwest Arkansas MSA alone. Now we are expected to raise more money from this growing population than ever before. So your financial contribution now more important than ever. I know you hear that sometimes in commercials or whatever, but we mean that because it is
the
truth.
We do mean that. It's, you know, so much, like we mentioned, so much of our budget comes from our local community, and we do absolutely mean it, that you are more important than ever, and every little bit helps. I know a lot of people think they don't have enough to give or what they give won't matter. It's not true. Anything you give is absolutely 100% going to count towards something, because that's how we do this. It's a community project, if you will. You know, pledge by pledge, we get to our goal of $150,000 this spring, and it's through our generous listeners who call and become contributing listeners.
And you can do that online right now
at supportkuaf.com.
And thank you. In about 20 minutes on Ozarks, we'll learn three things you should know about collecting coins.
But first, Arkansas voters are apparently largely in favor of an increase to the state's minimum wage, while voters appear to be split on the issue of medical marijuana in the state. According to the latest Talk Business Hendricks College poll of more than 1,000 likely Arkansas voters, 79% of those polled are in favor of the potential ballot measure that would raise the Arkansas minimum wage from $6.25 an hour to $8.50 an hour over a three-year period. Only 17% of those polled say they are against raising the minimum wage. Meanwhile, 45% of those polled are in favor of medical marijuana in Arkansas, while 45.5% are against any such measure.
Arkansas's law enforcement officers will begin a crackdown on distracted driving tomorrow as part of a national initiative to curb texting while driving. Corporal Chuck Lewis of the Arkansas State Police says the You Drive, You Text, You Pay program will incorporate a media outreach program and increased patrols around the state.
We're going to heavily use our low-profile vehicles, which are the colored cars. They're only marked on one side on the interstate system and all the roadways. We'll be using them to try to actually catch the drivers in the act, of poor driving, using poor driving decisions, and texting while they're driving.
During the six-day campaign, police will be on the lookout for all kinds of distracted driving, following too closely and improper lane changes. Fines for texting while driving can be as high as $100.
The area's unemployment rate saw noticeable declines in February. According to the latest data from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, the jobless rate in Northwest Arkansas was pegged at 5.6% for the month, a decline of 0.3% from January and a 0.5% decline from February 2013. The area's overall labor force was roughly 233,800 in February, increases over the previous month and over February 2013. The unemployment rate in the Fort Smith metro area also dropped during February. The rate was 7.4% during the month, a decline from 7.8% in January, and a decline from 8.8% in February 2013. Fort Smith's overall labor force grew to 128,600 people in February, an increase of about 1,000 jobs from January, but still about 1,600 people smaller than last year.
If you were planning on attending Maya Angelou's discussion Friday evening at the Fayetteville Public Library, then we have some unfortunate news. The library announced yesterday that the event has been canceled on account of the author's health. The event will not be rescheduled, and ticket holders for both the library and the University of Arkansas Hillside Auditorium venues will be notified by email. This is the first time in the 10 years of the library's series of author discussions that a cancellation has been made.
Yesterday's special elections resulted in no change in city leadership in West Fork and a growth to the physical area of Prairie Grove. 330 West Fork voters chose interim mayor Charlie Rossetti to continue serving as mayor through the end of the year, while only 127 votes were cast in favor of political outsider Steve Winkler. And despite somewhat lower voter turnout in Prairie Grove, 80 people voted in favor of annexing land surrounding the Highway 62 bypass, while 70 city residents voted against the annexation measure.
The University of Arkansas's Fulbright College has more than a million reasons to celebrate today. The college this morning announced that Robert and Sandra Connor of Little Rock and Dallas have pledged $1.5 million toward an endowed faculty fellowship in Fulbright College. According to the university, the fellowship will support teaching, research, service, and career development of the college's full-time junior-level faculty.
Last night, the Razorback baseball team dropped a 10-7 decision to UNLV at Baum Stadium. The loss puts Arkansas at 20-13 on the season. The Razorbacks conclude the two-game home series this evening.
Mostly clear tonight with lows around 49 degrees. Tomorrow, expect mostly sunny skies with highs from 76 in northwest Arkansas to 79 in the Arkansas River Valley. Partly cloudy tomorrow night with lows in the mid-50s.
This is Ozarks at Large. Last week, Arkansas-based St. Vincent's parent company, Catholic Health Initiatives, acquired a Hot Springs hospital owned by Mercy Health for an undisclosed sum. The move expands St. Vincent's footprint into that part of the state. The next day, an announcement that Catholic Health would acquire Little Rock-based health insurance provider QualChoice. Couple those moves with health care reform in Arkansas, a March 31st enrollment deadline for federal health care, and changes in Arkansas's health care policies? Well, you have a lot to diagnose. Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas recently sat down with the CEO of QualChoice, Mike Stock, and Arkansas State Senator David Sanders, a Republican from Little Rock, to get their take on the latest changes in health care in Arkansas.
Let's start with what this acquisition of QualChoice actually means. Is this going to be good for QualChoice, good for Arkansas? What are the advantages, and maybe what are some of the disadvantages of this acquisition?
I think it'll be good for both QualChoice and Arkansas. As you know, CHI, Catholic Health Initiatives, one of the largest providers of health care in the country. They're in 18 states, and they have a plan to expand their footprint in financing health care, and they want to use QualChoice as the administrative center for doing that and run all their administrative operations through this
operation. I like the sound of that, because that sounds like you're going to have to hire more people to handle more administrative functions, which sounds like high-paying jobs to me.
That's the plan down the road. There'll be expansion here.
What about expansion of the health insurance products that you have, opportunities for you guys outside of Arkansas in that respect?
The system is interested in both getting more involved in Medicare Advantage products and in the commercial market. They'll do that by looking, I'm sure, at other acquisition targets are by standing up new plans in those markets, and I expect us to be expanding into the Medicare Advantage products lines here in Arkansas.
Senator Sanders, you're all about competition in the marketplace. Yeah. This seems to be bolstering some competition here.
Well, it is, and again, if you look at sort of the traditional roles that insurers, healthcare entities, and doctors have played, I mean, so what we're seeing and what we have seen for quite some time is movement in how sort of the traditional players are organized and how they move forward. So I think this is a sort of an indication of what's to come, not only here in Arkansas, but I think nationally as well. So, in CHI is a major player nationally. They have been doing innovative initiatives in healthcare outside of the state of Arkansas as well. And so, I think it's a net positive, so long as what we try not to do is not to move with the market changes. You know, we have a tendency as policymakers and regulators to hold fast and hold true to how things were organized. Mm-hmm. This world of healthcare is changing before our very eyes. In fact, Arkansas is part of that change nationally. And so I think there's another reason for people to be watching Arkansas.
Is there anything from a regulatory perspective or a legislative perspective that you think might need to change to do what Senator Sanders is talking about, make this marketplace more competitive?
There are different ways to create competitiveness in the marketplace. You can do it either just with pure brute force and pricing, or you can do it by devising alternative kinds of ways of delivering the product and care. And I think there are going to be those kinds of opportunities here. Arkansas has a law that deals with any willing provider, which makes it a little bit more challenging to create alternative ways of putting together networks of providers. But those kinds of things are developing across the country. Accountable care organizations are a phenomenon that was promoted and pushed through the Affordable Care Act. And I think you're beginning to see those develop here in Arkansas, too.
Well, anything on your agenda?
Well sure. And I think we have to be careful. So, I mean, we don't want to, you know, in the name of innovation, throw out the baby with the bathwater, and that we just move and change things, wave things, make changes. I mean, St. Vincent was one of the lead proponents of any willing provider in Arkansas decades ago. And look, I think it has served the state well in many respects. So I think what we need to do is every policy debate that we have and every conversation that we have about the regulatory framework, the legal framework is, we have to acknowledge that we are operating in a new environment and laws that were passed. And again, we're looking at this in terms of Medicaid. We're looking at it in terms of all kinds of programs that the state has. You know, a lot of the programs we have were created and contemplated in an environment where you didn't have the proliferation of coverage. So we're all moving together on this. And I think that's the important thing that we do, is that we're mindful that, you know, a move here and it can affect something over here.
Let's talk about in the Democrat Gazette this past week, there was a news report that highlighted QualChoice's kind of low-keying its participation in the private option. Obviously, that was by somewhat design because you had something bigger in the works there. A self-imposed cap of 1,280 plans. Senator Sanders, you said you might need some clarification on this.
Well,
I'm going to give you an opportunity for some clarification here.
So I knew the fact that they had requested a cap. I didn't know that it was that small. Now, obviously, if they're in negotiations with a potential buyout purchase and someone else acquiring them, you know, the private option is a very innovative policy. And there's a lot of uncertainty in terms of that population, you know, utilization, you know, how they are going to adapt to something that they've never had before, and that is health insurance. So I understand that. I guess my hope is I do know that CHI and QualChoice they will be more capitalized. Mike, I look forward to you guys participating more in the private option. And again, we have information on the population now. So what was unknown is less unknown. There's still some uncertainty there, don't get me wrong, but I think there's an opportunity for QualChoice to participate and be even more price competitive.
Well, I think the answer to the issue, Roby, is, I mean, we knew that with insurance companies like banks, they have to be capitalized at certain reserve levels based upon the size of the business that they have and the volume that they have. with this large influx of new lives coming into the marketplace, QualChoice knew that we were going to add capital to the company to participate in that arena. In discussion with the shareholders, there was an avenue that was being worked to get there. We thought it was going to wrap up and be finished quicker, but in many times, you know, these transactions drag on.
You don't get to control those things.
You don't get to control the negotiations and the lawyering that goes into putting these transactions together. And so it took longer to get to the finish line where we want it to be. And because of that, the Department of Insurance worked with us to kind of control the flow of lives into the plan as that was being finished. And we hope that the whole transaction will close by the end of this month, and then we'll turn the spigot back on.
Well, so, I mean, to your point about me wanting and others wanting more competition, right. I think what we have seen here and what has been demonstrated with their experience is that, one, we will work with carriers. And what you've seen, obviously, AM Better come into the marketplace. They're a new competitor. We want others. Mike might not want to hear that. And Blue Cross Blue Shield might not want to hear that. AM Better may not want to hear that. But in this ever-changing environment, we think, again, Arkansas has the youngest pool in terms of its exchange in the country. We think that will be borne out as we begin to plan for plan year 2015. Some of the things that we're looking at with health savings accounts to encourage consumerism and healthcare, one of our favorite words. I think it will have an impact, but I mean, let it you know, take note that Arkansas has shown that they will work with their folks, take a longer approach. What we wouldn't have wanted to happen is for the state to say, no, you got to be in. They couldn't have pulled it off, and then, you know, it be, you know, maybe not a failure, but it may have not have gone off as well.
We're hitting around the edges of some of this, too. We're all talking about there's a lot of data out there now for you guys to make some more informed decisions. Obviously, we'd like to have more data. Mike, let me come to you on this. The goal of the Affordable Care Act was obviously to control costs. The private option was to control costs. The payment initiative that the state has embarked on is a cost control initiative. What are you seeing in the numbers? What's working, what's not working? I know it's a broad, vague question, but where do you see the data pointing you in the right direction?
Well, first of all, the amount of data we have right now is very small and still very immature, with the lives just coming on starting January 1 and claims beginning to be paid. But in terms of controlling costs and bringing down the cost of healthcare, one thing you have to remember is that insurance companies don't drive the cost of healthcare. We are financiers of the cost of health care. The government finances health care. The actual cost of health care is determined at the point of origin where it's delivered by the providers. That's where the cost is. And so what insurance companies try and do is work with those providers to make sure that at that point of care delivery, the delivery is as efficient and cost-effective as possible. And there's a lot of things going on in the state, like the Arkansas Payment Improvement Initiative, patient-centered medical homes, episodic payments. To try and do those things and bring costs down and make the proposition more of a value-based purchase for the consumer.
But where are you seeing movement?
We are beginning to see movement. One, in the patient-centered medical homes, there's a demonstration project going on in the state right now that's being directed by the federal government. It's called the CPCI. All the carriers, along with Medicaid, are participating in that. We're seeing reduced utilization at the emergency room through that program. Episodic payments, we've seen so far in the first part of last year that the cost of hip replacements that we're doing in the state have come down a little over 2%, which doesn't sound like a lot, on a big number, you know, a couple percentage points can make a big difference.
And so it's a high reimbursement item too, as well. So that is significant.
Do you see things in this respect?
I do. I look at it in terms of what are the missing components. And so, and again, you know, a lot of us, you know, want healthcare to function like a marketplace and an open market and a freer marketplace. But in order to have that, you both have to have both quantitative and qualitative measurements. And that requires openness and transparency. And if you look at historically, you look at all the players in healthcare, you know, the move hasn't been for openness and transparency in terms of quality and price. And those are sort of the missing components and sort of the what lies ahead on the horizon, where we have to go from a policy standpoint. And we think that will benefit, because the truth is we will begin and continue to accumulate large portions of data. And what we need to happen is we need all of those involved. I'm sort of an equal opportunity skeptic. When an insurance lobbyist comes at me, a doctor lobbyist comes at me, or a hospital lobbyist, and a government bureaucrat even. So we have to look at everyone with guarded skepticism, because what has to happen is we can't operate in silos and do what is in our best interest, but we have to move the ball down the field, operating in the best interest of the consumer and the taxpayer.
Roby Brock talked with the CEO of QualChoice, Mike Stock, and Arkansas State Senator David Sanders, a Republican from Little Rock, about changes that have happened and are going to happen in Arkansas's health care. Support for Talk Business Arkansas on Ozarks at Large is provided by AT&T, encouraging drivers to take the pledge to never text and drive. No text is worth the risk. More information at itcanwait.com. And Bank of the Ozarks, committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. BankoftheOzarks.com. And the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas. Diversity is the key to reliability and affordability. From the state's largest industrial user to a home at the end of a long country road, the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas serve members with a stable supply of electricity backed up with fuel diversity: coal, oil, natural gas, hydropower, and renewables. More at AECC.com. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks at Large, preparing Hamlet for stage at Theater Square. That's later on this edition of Ozarks at Large. But right now,
this reminder, this is the Spring On Air fundraiser, a time when we remind our listeners how important and vital they are to us staying on the air here at KUAF. Year after year, people call in and pledge online and show their support for their public radio station, and we ask that you do that now if you haven't done so yet. We have sent our phone volunteers home for the day, but you can still contribute online at supportkuaf.com. The website is always there and open, but why not go ahead and make that contribution now while you're thinking about it?
Yeah, why not? We were talking a few minutes ago, and we mentioned that 66% of our budget comes from local listeners and the local businesses. Mentioned that 88% we're responsible for in-house, raising through grants or whatever. Someone had said to me a few months ago, wouldn't it be great if you just had one or two interests that could give you a lot of money and you wouldn't have to ask for so much? But the problem with that, and I have known people who've worked at public radio stations that have had that situation. Mm-hmm. Maybe their university gave them a bulk of their – if that funding goes away – you're out of luck. Mm-hmm. Or if, and I don't know anyone where this has happened, but if someone gives you a lot of money and they say, well, we'd rather you do this or rather you not do that, you kind of have to listen. The great thing about having so many investors across the board is that those are not problems. If someone moves away, well, there are a few thousand people to help out. And no one, you know, the great thing about public radio is that no one has undue or more influence than anybody else.
No.
It's a work of unity.
I think that's a testament that every contribution matters, though,
right,
too, because it takes thousands of contributions to make up that humongous percentage of our over $1 million budget. So, I mean, even if you can only give $20 right now, it really adds up because it adds on to the contribution that was $20 before yours,
right,
and makes 40. And then we just chip away at it until we make it.
Right. And it's worked for us for almost 30 years. It's been since 1985 that we've been an NPR station. And we first aired All Things Considered in 1985 because we had initial support from listeners. And we've been doing fundraisers since then. And it's worked.
And we hope that you will help ensure that it continues to work, that this model will continue to be here and support your public radio station. And by doing that, we ask that you make the choice to become a contributing listener and contribute online right now at supportkuaf.com. It is fast and simple. The site is secure. We try to make it as easy as possible for you to give the amount that you feel that you want to and in the manner that you choose.
All right. Support KUAF.com.
And thank you.
Every month on An Ozarks at Large Wednesday, we select a topic that has attracted our curiosity and find out just a bit more about it. Since this particular Wednesday falls within our spring fundraiser, we thought a money-related topic would be appropriate for this month's edition of Three Things. Our search to learn three things about coin collecting took us to Garrison Avenue in downtown Fort Smith. DBKJ Numismatics Rare Coins and Currency is open most weekdays from 10 until 4. Dale White, the owner, has been in the rare coin and currency business for 23 years, and he says he's been a collector his entire life. He says collectors of coins, stamps, baseball cards, whatever, are just a bit genetically different from non-collectors. For him, the coin collecting interest began in his father's grocery store in southern Arkansas, examining the change from the cash register. So I asked Dale to offer us three truths about coin collecting. Number one, the hobby probably won't make you filthy rich.
Probably not likely. There's very few things today in circulation that have value above the face value of the coins. There's still things that people can collect out of circulation, like the state quarters, the national park quarters. Those kind of coins you collect because you like them. You don't collect them because they're valuable. But it is fun for kids or novice collectors to see how many different ones they can get or if they can complete the set from circulation.
So that complete set of U.S. state quarters? Worth a little more than face value, maybe. The Susan B. Anthony dollars? Worth a dollar. Wheat pennies? The 1 cent piece minted from 1909 through 1958? Are worth more than 1 cent.
Right now, we're selling bags of 5,000 for about $200, which makes them about 4 cents a piece in quantity.
Truth about coin collecting number two, coins are a direct connection to history. Dale showed me one of his favorite coins on Monday afternoon.
It's a 1794 half dollar. That's the first year that a half dollar was made by the United States. And if you hold that in your hands or just cover it and think about it a minute, George Washington was still president when that was made. John Adams had been elected but had not taken office yet. And if that coin could tell the story from the time it left the U.S. Mint in Philadelphia until it arrived in my hands in Fort Smith, Arkansas, some 225 years later or so, what story would it tell?
He says only 23,464 copies of that particular coin were minted. It's nearly impossible to figure out how many are left on the planet, but compare that to the hundreds of millions or even a billion minted of a particular contemporary coin. Dale's 1794 half dollar is a bit dingy. It takes some close inspection to make out the date.
Part of it looks a little bit gray, a little bit dark. Part of it is it's all original. It's never been cleaned. It's not been messed with. This coin clean would probably be worth half of what it's worth.
Really?
So the originality adds to the value.
So you want that history.
Yes.
You want that patina.
You want that
there.
Patina. You want the originality.
And a third truth about coin collecting, paper currency can become worth plenty in a hurry. Well, certain paper currency anyway.
Paper money or currency has a shelf life or active life in circulation of about 18 months. Coins generally will last about 30 years. So you're right. It has a much shorter shelf life. Generally, the Bureau of Engraving and Printing that prints our paper money produces larger volumes of paper money. So there's more quantity in circulation. The turnover is a lot faster. But it is quite collectible. Some of the early designs and some of what's called the large size notes or saddle blanket notes made before 1928 when the currency was physically larger has some really, really beautiful designs. It's highly desirable. It's highly collected. And there's some stuff that's a bit economical, but it can get very pricey very quick.
But again, that really valuable out-of-circulation currency probably isn't tucked away in the garage or in your grandparents' cedar chest. I asked Dale about U.S. paper money with the words silver certificate on them that I had inherited from grandparents.
Do those have any extra value to them?
A little bit. I have a bundle of 100, I'd probably sell you for $150. Okay. So it's a nominal value thing again.
Okay, so you're not going to get rich. But the real joy of collecting isn't about getting wealthy anyway. Dale says collecting coins and currency offers an infinite supply of collectible pieces of history and art.
There's almost always a story, but people have different motives. Some people are just what I call hoarders. They collect with no specific goal or theme. They just gather up things that they like. Other people are very, very meticulous and very, very detailed. They collect certain series, only the finest they can get in that series. They keep meticulous notes of everything that they do. So in collecting, it's probably in any genre of collecting, not just coin collecting. There are different types of collectors within that group.
Dale White is the owner of DBKJ Numismatics Rare Coins and Currency, located on Garrison Avenue in downtown Fort Smith. He told me three things about coin collecting when I visited his shop on Monday afternoon.
Oh, I'm on? Okay. Hi, this is R.J. Mischel. One more time. Take four. This is R.J. Mischel. I'll be with my buddy Paul next Friday night at 9 p.m. on the next edition of the Generic Blues Show right here at KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Arkansas.
It is Wednesday, April 9th, 2014. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And with us now is Becca Martin Brown, features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
You want to take any stabs at today's theme?
Wacky Wednesday?
Oh, I love Wacky Wednesday, but no.
Okay.
I don't know.
Wilderness Wednesday.
No.
Okay.
But also good. Thank you for the idea.
You're welcome.
No, this is Traveling Wednesday.
Oh, I like that.
Places and things you need to see in the immediate future on the road. On April 11th, which is Friday,
mm-hmm.
Billy Joel is at the Scott Trade Center in St. Louis.
Oh.
On the 19th, George Strait is at the BOK Center in Tulsa.
Country classic.
On April 22nd and 23rd, Michael Jackson, the Immortal World Tour by Cirque du Soleil at the Verizon Arena in Little Rock.
I think I would love that.
Huh.
I think it would be fascinating, if nothing else.
I love Cirque du Soleil.
I've never seen Cirque du Soleil.
May 21st, the Dave Matthews Band is at the BOK Center in Tulsa. And on June 10th, Bruno Mars is at the Verizon Arena in North Little Rock.
Oh.
And if you want to check out any of these things, we have a listing called Arts Away and What's Up every Friday.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Just taking a couple of minutes here during the evening edition of Ozarks at Large to remind you that this is the spring fundraiser. It's a little calmer now in the building in the Carver Center for Public Radio than it is during the hours previous to the evening edition of Ozarks, because we've sent everybody home. Almost everybody.
Well, just about.
We're still here.
Everybody
yes.
but us. But we're not answering volunteers' phone calls. I mean,
we're not
listeners.
Ignoring them.
Right, no.
we don't have our phone volunteers here after 7 o'clock. But we do know you're listening, and we do know you appreciate KUAF, and we do have a way for you to contribute to KUAF, even though we don't have phone volunteers.
Yes, you can log on to supportkuaf.com to make your contribution there on our secure, safe website.
It's as simple as that. You determine the amount. If you've never given before and perhaps you're a little bit baffled about what to give, mm-hmm. we have some suggestions.
We do. Sometimes we tell people if you think that KUAF is worth, say, a buck a day, maybe try $52. Or if you think it's worth a dollar a day, then it's $365. If you want to be a member of our NPR society, you can give $1,000 or more. It is whatever your budget allows you to do and whatever amount of time you spend listening to KUAF, allow that to kind of be your judge. I will say that our average pledge is about $104.
About $104, right.
So about $2 a week.
Right. And rest assured that if you think KOF is worth more than you can afford, if you think, yeah, it is worth a dollar a day or a, something, but you can't afford that, that's okay.
Yeah.
Because throw in your budget into consideration as well.
Absolutely. The fact that you. The fact that you give it all is huge. Like,
right.
I think we talk about the inertia of not giving, I guess, you know, that you just sort of get in this habit that you don't give because, well, you've been listening and you just didn't find the time, or maybe you do it later and then you run out of time and then you don't do it.
Or somebody else is doing it.
Or somebody else is doing it for you. And so you just don't do that. So the fact that you make the choice to give and then, you know, log on to supportkuf.com and make that there is huge. That is a huge step. And we are very appreciative of all of our listeners who do that.
And you can do it right now online
at supportkuaf.com.
And thank you. Theater Squared's eighth season has been its most ambitious yet, opening with the original play, The Spiritualist, recent Pulitzer and Tony-nominated plays, and an inventive production of A Christmas Carol. The last full production of the season opens tomorrow, and it's a production that wraps up a stunning season appropriately, Hamlet. Grant Goodman makes his T2 debut as the title character, and Sean Patrick Riley, last seen here in the cast of T2's Good People this winter, is directing. Both gentlemen came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio during the first week of rehearsals to talk about the play, a work director Sean Patrick Riley says is in a class all of its own.
I think it's the greatest play in the English language, and I also think that Hamlet is the greatest role for an actor to play. And so when Bob Ford first approached me about directing this, last summer, I guess it was, my first question was, why? Why do Hamlet? And we had a discussion about that, and he brought up all these things. This is the greatest play ever written, and I agree. And this idea of that we were going to do it with eight or nine actors, and my response to him was, as a director, I don't know that I'm interested in directing Hamlet at T2. What I am interested in is T2 doing Hamlet, because there's a certain aesthetic that the theater has established that is about honesty and truth. And so when we began casting, one of the great things about being an actor who works a lot, and you know, I'm based out of New York, as you know, and the second that the word gets out that you're directing Hamlet, you hear from guys that you worked with 15 years ago.
Really?
Who are like, you're directing Hamlet. I'm in. You know, can I come read for you? I saw a lot of actors for this part, as you would. Grant came into the room. He read for us. And for me, it was a done deal. He gave a fantastic read. I have a very specific way of working with actors, even in a rehearsal. I mean, rather in an audition process where I just want to sit down and have a conversation with the text. Just talk to me. Mm-hmm. And you were very amenable to that. And I knew before he left the room that he was my Hamlet. Absolutely. I was like, yeah, this is the guy. And was excited to start right away.
Did you have a good feeling?
I did. You know, the things I've been thinking just in the week that we've been working on this so far is that I'm terribly lucky to have such a symbiotic relationship with my director. Mm-hmm. And I knew that from the get-go. I knew that from the audition we had a very similar way of working, and that's proved to be true since we've begun rehearsals last week. I had a good feeling about it. I knew that we were on the same page. I could tell straight away that Sean was all about what we call original practices, which is sort of a way of performance that they think was the closest way to the way the plays were performed at the Globe in the day. And so him sitting down and interviewing me, which is a very British sort of tradition, and right. I wish that more American casting directors and directors would operate this way, which was it was more of an interview.
Right.
And that's you get to know the person. Well, you sit down and say,
and I believe we're
can
interviewing,
I work with that person?
Yeah, I believe we're interviewing each other
mm-hmm.
as well. One of the problems, I think, is, the actor is the last person hired and the first person sort of dismissed in a lot of ways. And I feel as an actor that if I'm coming into a room to audition for you, yes, I'm here because I want a job. But also, do I want to spend the next X, you know, with a play, it can be, you know, if a play runs for a year, mm-hmm. you're going to spend a year with this person. But more specifically, do we agree on how this should be done? And I think that it's really important that the actor have that in mind, that it's getting the job is not why you walk into an audition. You walk into an audition because you have 5 minutes to do exactly what you were put on the planet to do, which is act. So come in and act. And then let me sit down with you as a director and say, hey, how is it that you work? Because so much of the actor-director relationship that often takes a lot of rehearsal time is, okay, this is how this person works. How are we going to work together? So in an audition, especially, you know, when Mr. Goodman came in, I could feel right away that we could forego that in rehearsal because, you know, not only this idea of approaching the play from the point of view of original practices or original acting practices, as they're sometimes called, but are you willing to roll with it here? And I think that's a lot of the reason that a director in an audition, a good director, I feel, in an audition, will throw something at you, not because that's the way they want you to play the part, but just to see whether or not you can take direction.
When you mention original practices,
right.
How is an original practice different than what might be a quote-unquote normal or more conventional rehearsal?
Right. It was started or really developed by there was a guy by the name of Sam Wanamaker who was a impresario and producer, and he and an actor-director by the name of Marc Rolance, who is currently, I believe, still working in New York doing a rep of Twelfth Night and Richard III. Mark was the first artistic director of what's the Globe Theater in London. And they did a lot of research, as Grant was just saying, they did a lot of research to determine how is it that they actually did these plays. How is it that Romeo and Juliet in the prologue, is it the prologue or the epilogue?
Prologue.
The prologue says, this is the 2 hours traffic on our stage. And generally, and specifically in America, when you see Romeo and Juliet, it's 3.5-4 hours long. You go, well, what is this 2 hours traffic on our stage? So in doing all this research, they found that certain things had to be true, that there was no real set changes, that you allowed the language to tell the story. Because part of the burden on the actor in a Shakespeare play is you're not only handling the dialogue, but you're also handling the lion's share of the narrative. This is where we are. This is what time of day it is. So that if we could strip away everything that's not necessary, so strip away the set dressing and say, you know what? If there's two goblets that are being used in this scene, we don't need six goblets. We need two. And it focuses and pares down so that the emphasis is on the actor and what they're saying. And to not impose something upon the play and upon the audience, but just say, this is the play. Let's hear it for the first time.
Let's talk about the soliloquy. When do you talk about it? Because arguably the most famous words originally written in the English language.
Mm-hmm.
Do you approach it any differently than you do the rest of the script?
No, I think that's the trap. I think that if you think of, oh, here comes the famous soliloquy, mm-hmm. then you're really ruined before you start. It has to be part of the through line of the play. It has to be part of the backwards and forwards of the play. I assume you're talking about to be or not to be.
I am, yes.
There's no escaping it, and I think that everyone knows in the room. I know Sean has an interesting story, with the, and this is another blessing that I have, is Sean has played the role twice himself, and so that's a special gift for me to have his insight on that front. But I know that he has a funny story about coming out one night and saying to be.
Yeah, the first time I did the play, I was fortunate enough to work with the great director and teacher from the Royal Shakespeare Company, a gentleman by the name of John Barton. And he was always pushing me to drive the story forward. And he said to me one night, okay, I know you want to wallow. And I was young at the time, admittedly. He said, I know you want to wallow a bit more in to be or not to be. And I said, yeah, I think that he's really struggling with himself, when in fact, as an actor, I wanted to, quote unquote, perform that mm-hmm. very famous speech. And he said, all right, my dear, take the pause that you feel is in it. Because for me, it was not to be or not to be. That is the question, whether it is not. It was to be or not to be. You know, in that very right. Laurence Olivier clipped right. voice, to be or not to be. And he said, try it one night. And he said, see what happens. So I got out and took my spot. And I said, to be. And from the audience, or not to be. And I wound up pointing to the guy in the audience and saying, that is the question. So, yeah, in approaching that particular speech and some other, there's a lot of really famous lines in this play. It has to be about the story. Where is Hamlet? I think that more than any other play, definitely more than any other play before, and perhaps since, Hamlet represents an absolute historic moment, not just in the theater or in literature, but for human beings, which is, it's truly the first time that someone's inner life is exposed publicly. And that particular speech, it's questions that we've all contemplated. Why are we here? What is the meaning of this? Is letting go, is death easier than life? And I believe that the conclusion of it is perhaps to live in difficult circumstance, facing insurmountable tasks, is harder. And that's the choice I'm going to make. I'm going to take the hard road. I believe that's what Hamlet is saying.
You know, Harold Bloom, who's a great Shakespearean critic, talks about this play as being a very experimental play.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost Brechtian mm-hmm. in a way. And as I was preparing to play it, memorizing lines, et cetera, I realized that his very first line is an aside to the audience. So from the get-go, he sort of forms this bond with the audience that he will then continue to keep throughout the play. And I think that the opening of his soul to an audience, directly to an audience in this case, is what makes Hamlet Hamlet. I think we do a very poor job in the United States about training an audience, and I don't mean by being didactic and teaching them, but in original practices, it's very clear that the audience is part of the play from the very beginning, from the second they enter the theater, that they're in the same room as the actors. We're so steeped in America in fourth wall tradition. So I think that our Shakespeare in America sometimes suffers because of that. So we put up that fourth wall and we do, like Sean says, sort of wallow in these monologues as if they are to ourselves, as if they're private moments, and they're not. They're shared moments, and they are a soliciting. And I think that when I was doing a production of the Scottish play. We're not in a theater. I was doing a production of
Macbeth.
Yes. I was doing a production of Macbeth, and I was playing Macbeth, and I came out of the theater after the performance, and this lady stopped me on the street and said, She goes, I loved the show. She said, it felt like you were looking right at me. And I said, well, it's because I was looking right at you,
yeah.
You know?
You were there.
You were there. And I think that sometimes that frightens an audience. Sometimes an audience doesn't know how to take that. But then I think they start leaning forward in their seats and they start to become a part of it. And I think that's what good theater should be.
And, of course, at Theater Squared, if someone's leaning in the front row and leaning forward,
they're
in their
almost
seat,
on stage.
Yes. Yes, right
which
there.
Which is a great feeling.
Which yeah. I not only don't have a problem with, I encourage. The audience is central to this production.
They're the missing link.
And we will completely embrace that they are there, as opposed to, like Grant was just saying, this fourth wall aesthetic that I don't believe can in any way be imposed on a Shakespeare play. You know, as actors, particularly American actors, we are living in the shadow of Stanislavski and Lee Strasberg and Marlon Brando. And I think one thing that we forget is Stanislavski, in his desire to bring truth to the stage, was reacting to a very stylized 19th century acting. I don't believe that method actors, and I count myself as one, I am a method actor, I have a method of working, that is about telling the truth in the moment, that is about hitting your mark, looking the other fellow in the eye, and telling the truth. I don't believe that we have ownership of that in method acting, in Stanislavski-based training, because I do not believe in any way that in the Elizabethan theater, they weren't telling the truth. They were telling the truth. They were including the audience in the hearing of the truth, and I think that's what is... It may jar the audience here. We will be doing, not to give away too much about my production, but traditionally in the Elizabethan theater and embracing this in original practices, the play will begin with what we sometimes call lords and ladies or a promenade, that the actors will present themselves to the audience and then go to their places, and we will begin the play. So that we're constantly in mind that this is nine actors performing this play. That it's not, you're not here, you're not watching us, we're in this private place where you have been invited in a very privileged way to witness our work. That's not what's happening. It's, especially at the Theater Squared space, where it is so intimate, you are an absolute part of this story. Not just Mr. Goodman, but there's other actors in the play that have a side that will speak to the audience. Laertes will address the audience. Gertrude will address the audience. Ophelia will address the audience. In her deepest moment of doubt and pain, she's going to turn to the audience. Polonius, Claudius are all dealing with the audience. And saying, "Help me here, help me out here. Do you understand this?" And I believe the audience will, in their response, say, "I understand it. You are in an impossible situation. Go on." Yeah,
gentlemen, thank you both very much.
Thank you, Kyle. Always a pleasure.
Excerpts from a conversation with Grant Goodman and Sean Patrick Riley, the lead and director, respectively, for Theater Squared's production of Hamlet. The play opens at Nadine Baum Studios tomorrow night. You can find out more about Hamlet and Theater Squared at theater2.org. That's the number 2, theater2.org. And that's it for this Wednesday evening edition of Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
We'll all be back tomorrow at noon for a brand new edition of Ozarks at Large on KUAF. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, Farmington. Thanks for listening.